Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Bigger is, as we know, better. Maybe. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Monday, the 9th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Size matters in business, right? Economies of scale, resiliency, straight up intimidating your competitors. Hello, Amazon. Bigger is better. Provided, one billionaire activist investor said today, it's the right kind of big. Paul Singer and the hedge fund he runs, it's called Elliott Management, announced this morning it's bought up $3.2 billion worth of AT&T stock. And it wants the company to refocus. You might remember AT&T just bought Time Warner, has been doing a whole lot of acquiring overall of late. Elliott calls it a, and this is a quote, a sprawling collection of businesses at a time when maybe bigger isn't better. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
Buying a bunch of different companies and sticking them under one corporate umbrella was a popular strategy in the 1960s. But conglomerates are largely out of vogue today.
Conglomerates are more out of fashion than the clothing I wear.
Eric Gordon, professor at the University of Michigan's Business School, assures me that's saying something. He says these days it's much more fashionable to focus, to do one thing well, rather than be mediocre at many unrelated things.
In fact, a lot of hedge fund activists have attacked company after company on the basis that the companies were not focused enough. They were looking too much like conglomerates.
AT&T has been a serial acquirer in recent years, says Vivek Stalam, an analyst at New Street Research.
The thing that sort of separates maybe AT&T from Verizon as far as its M&A strategy is they've really invested outside of what would have been considered their core business a few years ago.
They bought satellite TV provider DirecTV and Time Warner, a media company that owns HBO and Warner Brothers. But unlike the conglomerates of old, think GE making light bulbs and jet engines, AT&T's investments have more in common, says Ian Greenblatt. He leads the telecom and media practice at J.D. Power.
While they may be apples and oranges, they're not apples and doorknobs, right? The distribution of content requires some medium. AT&T is expert in those media.
In other words, it now makes content and distributes it. Greenblatt says that may well make sense for AT&T, but it's still going to be a challenge to put the pieces together. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
With the caveat that you should always consult your own financial advisor, a story now about trading on President Trump's tweets, which you should not do. But the professionals at J.P. Morgan have found a way to quantify how much markets are likely to move when he tweets, the bond market specifically. The bank has launched an index showing a statistically significant relationship between presidential tweets and market volatility. The Volfefe Index, they're calling it. It's a portmanteau of volatility and, yes, Covfefe, the word the president coined, accidentally, one assumes, in a 2017 tweet. Marketplace Justin Ho explains what's going on here.
The index looks at the timing of Trump tweets, their frequency, and most importantly, their content. J.P. Morgan found that when a tweet contains the word China, it has a 70% chance of moving bond yields. The word tariffs is likely to move markets too, along with products and dollars.
It's as if we're adding another gauge on the dashboard.
That's John Bai at Northeastern University. Last week, Bank of America Merrill Lynch reported that when Trump tweets more often, stock markets tend to go in one direction, down. J.P. Morgan's index doesn't indicate which direction the bond market will move. It's just a measure of volatility. And investors pay close attention to volatility so they can insure themselves against swings in the market. Stefano Giglio studies volatility at the Yale School of Management.
There's a huge demand for financial products that allow you to basically buy protection.
There are other indexes out there that measure market volatility, but they clump all of it together. Giglio says the Volfefe Index specifically measures political volatility.
it allows investors to find a more specific hedge for their needs.
JP Morgan found that more of Trump's tweets have been moving the market lately. But Karen Cavanaugh at Voya Investment Management says that trend might not last for long.
Investors are increasingly becoming a little bit more Teflon to it.
Cavanaugh says this index is really only a measure of short-term moves in the market. For most investors, that matters far less than the fundamentals of the economy. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, not a whole lot of volatility, actually, as far as Volfefe. I don't even know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Those out there who follow me on Twitter know this already. And if you don't follow me, here's the plug. I'm at Kai Ryssdal, KaiRyssdal. But those who do follow me know that from time to time, when the president says things like, we're taking in billions of dollars in tariff money, sometimes he adds from the Chinese, well, when that happens, I kind of lose it. And more often than not, I respond, usually in all caps, that those billions of dollars are coming from American consumers, the ones who are paying the tariffs. Well, same thing happened the other day, and a guy named Kevin Feig tweeted back at me saying, hey, it's not just the consumer, Kai, it's businesses too. Like his, an auto parts company in Miami called Foreign Parts Distributors. So you know what's coming now. We got Kevin Feig on the phone. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai. Pleasure to be with you.
So set me straight, as you did on Twitter the other day. What's it like for you, I guess, stuck in the middle, right, between the Commerce Department and the rules on tariffs and your consumers?
Well, that's correct, Kai. It's a very helpless feeling. My company has been in business for, over 45 years. And for the past 10, 15 years, the predominant country that we've imported parts from is China. And, the difficulty is that the customs has enacted a first 10% tariff rate and then a 25% tariff rate. And there's no negotiating there. Right now, we're paying 27.5% duties. And we're forced as a company, like thousands of other importers, to raise our prices to our customers. And those customers raise their prices to their customers, and eventually it trickles down to the consumer. So yes, money is pouring into U.S. Treasury from these tariffs, but the money is not coming from Chinese factories. The money is coming from U.S. consumers, right, and U.S. companies.
What happens when you go to your customers and say, hey, look, the tariffs are 27.5%. I got to pass at least some of this on. What do they say to you?
Most of my customers, certainly are aware of the situation, but no companies just accept price increases without a fight. And we've had to absorb a little bit of a loss because when you're, dealing with customer negotiations, sometimes you need to give a little in order to keep the business.
And what's that meaning for your people? Are you laying people off? Are you cutting pay? What are you doing?
We have not laid anybody off specifically related to the situation. That's the last thing we want to do. If business is affected more severely, more dramatically in the future, certainly we would have to consider doing that. But that's not something that we've done to date. We have tried to reduce costs in other areas to help offset the reduced profitability, but we have not laid people off as of yet.
If this trade conflict, as you say, keeps being ongoing, then what do you do at your company?
So, when the tariffs first went into effect, we looked into diversifying our supplier network mm-hmm. a little bit more. The problem is, Kai, and I can't speak for every industry. I can only mm-hmm. speak for mine. I don't sell ballpoint pens. I can't just say, well, I'm getting my blue pens from China, and now I'll go get them from Bangladesh. What I sell is a technical product. I have over 6,000 part numbers. And when you're going 70 miles an hour on the highway, if you have one of my parts installed in your vehicle, the quality of that part keeps your car on the road. And we take that very seriously. And to move even a single part number from one supplier to another is a very exhaustive process that requires a lot of time and research and testing.
All of which are costing you money, right?
That's correct. That's correct. My time, my quality control team has, we've spent, certainly over 70% of our time over the last year just looking at, alternative sourcing outside of China.
Kevin Feig, he's the executive vice president at a firm his dad started 45-something years ago, foreign parts distributors out of Miami, Florida, does auto parts. Kevin, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Kai.
As you may know, President Trump is talking about more tariffs on more things from more countries than just China. We took a look at some of the untapped economic powers the president has. You can check it out at marketplace.org. About 6, maybe 7 years ago, there was a stretch where I was traveling a lot, like a lot. And so my expense reports began to pile up. And after a while, there was a pretty big pile. So big that it was easier to ignore it than it would have been to track down all the receipts and remember what was for what trip and get the whole thing taken care of. Long story short, after some not-so-veiled threats from the finance department, I did them. 7 months' worth of expenses, $8,000-something. Suffice it to say, my boss, she was not pleased. But that's why a column in the Wall Street Journal today caught my eye. "Your expense report is a window into your soul," was the title. Sue Schellenbarger wrote it. Sue, it's good to have you on.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. So if, as the headline of this column says, your expense report is a window into your soul, what does my little foible up there that I said in the introduction, what does that say about my soul?
You're probably a guy who feels time-pressed, doesn't want to do those reports, especially when they spill over into the weekend,
yeah.
Maybe even makes you a little anxious. A lot of us avoid expense reporting.
Because mostly it's just a gigantic pain in the patootie, right?
Well, exactly. Itemizing expenses, listing contacts, all of the details, and you have to go back into your ancient history.
Yeah.
They're really 1 in 5 of them are completed on weekends, which people don't like to do.
Yeah, no, don't do that for a work report. Let me ask you, though, about sort of the subhead of this piece or the through line, which is that it can tell you whether your job is making you happy. It talks also about your sense of ethics and fairness. There's a lot that's wrapped up in how fundamentally you spend the company's money.
Absolutely. And we're doing this all in absolute privacy, right? We fill these things out alone. So we say a lot about our attitude toward our employer.
Well, so give me a couple here. One of my favorite lines from this piece was one piece of advice that people are frequently given is spend the company's money like it was your own.
It really evokes wildly different responses. Yeah. Some people go out and spend on lavish meals and expensive flights, and then when asked about it, they say, "I am spending it like my own."
Right.
You know, other people just think that they should then, book a hostel or only one hotel room for two colleagues. I mean, or take the cheapest flight, even if they have a 5-hour layover. So it really evokes wildly divergent reactions.
Well, so that's a really good point, the layover bit in particular, right? Because there are the rules, but then there's also common sense and productivity and all of that that gets rolled into business travel.
This is what the CFOs I spoke to told me. They said especially younger workers who are growing in number don't have a sense of the value of time. You know, they think that as long as they're saving the nickel, mm-hmm. that's going to be a good thing.
So what are we supposed to do here? First of all, don't do them on weekends, right? And don't buy first-class tickets. But other than that, what do you do?
It's difficult. There are good new apps. I mean, SAP Concur and some of the other big vendors have excellent apps for smaller companies, Lola.com. Try to build it into your routine. Do them more quickly. Scan the receipts mm-hmm. right away. Put them into your app. You have to avoid letting them drag on and don't procrastinate.
What do you do? Are you punctual with these things?
I have to tell you that as soon as I filed this story, I immediately filed my expense report. I was only 3 months behind.
Oh, man. That's a lot. Sue Schellenbarger, she writes the Work and Family column at the Wall Street Journal. Sue, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
But I do miss the sunshine a little bit.
Summer's not over yet, people. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on a Monday. Dow Industrials up 38 points, about a 10th percent, 26,835. NASDAQ down 15 points, nearly 0.2%, 8,087. The S&P 500 basically flat, 29 and 78. AT&T, we told you about, Telecom shares rose 1.5% today. Other telecoms were mixed. Verizon down 0.2%. Sprint, though, gained about 1.3%. Shares of Chipotle, or Chipotle, I get it wrong every time, somebody correct me, gained 0.4% today as an investment firm raised its outlook. Stock, by the way, up 90% since January the 1st. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. According to the Census Bureau, something like 80% of the people in the United States live in urban areas, and the other 20% or so are rural. And that urban-rural divide, as social sciences like to call it, gets mentioned a lot in discussions of some of the disconnects in this country, political, social, also economic. So when a reporter at The Washington Post points to one particular rural county in Minnesota as the worst place to live in America, well, it raises some hackles. Christopher Ingram is that reporter who now lives, by the way, in that particular rural county in Minnesota. His book about crossing the divide is called If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now. Chris, thanks for coming on the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, why did you write in the pages of The Washington Post that Red Lake County, Minnesota is the worst place to live?
Well, Kai, it's important to know I wasn't just spouting off. This was the finding of a USDA data project that they actually ranked all 3,000-some-odd counties of the United States on what amounts to their natural beauty, right? Their climate, how warm or how cold, their landscape, things like that. And the place that was dead last was this little place called Red Lake County in northern Minnesota, a place I had never heard of. And so I said, hey, you know, according to the USDA, this is America's worst place to live.
And long story short, you heard from the folks in Red Lake County.
You know, Minnesota is kind of like the Texas of the North. You've heard about don't mess with Texas, but unless you've made Minnesotans angry, you really have no idea. There were many other places in the United States near Red Lake County, you know, places in North Dakota and Iowa that also came out very, very, very bad on this ranking. I didn't hear a peep from people in any of those places.
It's because all the rest of them weren't at the very bottom of the list, man. But look, all right, so you get all these emails and whatever from the folks in Red Lake County. You decide to pay a visit, and then long story short, you decide to move there. How did that come to pass?
Well, you know, so I went out to visit to do this follow-up story, and I was prepared to really not like the place very much, right? I was expecting kind of a hillbilly elegy kind of situation, right? But it was more like Norman Rockwell. It was just an incredible sense of community and warmth and just social cohesion that just seemed to be missing from my life, which was back in the Baltimore, D.C. metro area. And so, you know, as I got back from the trip, my wife and I were talking this over, and we were dealing with all these economic pressures that you're probably familiar with of living in a city, the cost of living, the commute, just the difficulties of doing basic everyday things. And as we were discussing all those things, I go out on this trip to Red Lake County. I come back saying, man, this place is awesome. And we decided, you know what, let's give it a shot and see what happens.
Okay, so let's take through a couple of things here. Obviously, housing is cheaper in rural Minnesota. You can work because your job as a data reporter with the Washington Post is portable. You're not going to have to pay child care because it turns out your wife can't work. I mean, there were some calculations that had to be made here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And these are the calculations that pretty much I imagine every family does. You know, you're looking at cost of living, you're looking at the, you know, just kind of crazy costs of childcare versus the amount of money that you would make working outside of the home. You know, we live in a country where, what is it, something like 80% of the population lives in these big metro areas where people are on some level dealing with these exact same issues. You know, our family, we were at that point where something had to give, and that's, you know, what we did. We ran the numbers. We said, all right, this is what we need.
I know you're a data guy, but there is a less quantitative aspect to your life now that you write about in this book, and that is the idea of social capital and what it has meant to you to be in a small town where everybody knows everybody and there are support systems that are just innate. They're just there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's one of the big benefits for us of, you know, moving to this area is, you know, winter in Northwest Minnesota is really brutal, and it just lasts. I mean, it's basically winter now, right? The temperature in my house was in the 30s this morning.
Oh,
it's
man,
brutal.
Really?
It lasts like forever. It was in the 30s. God. Yeah, it's crazy. But I can't tell you how relieving it is to be able to send our kids outside, you know, outside in our neighborhood and just not have to watch them and know that they're going to be okay. The more time we spend out here, the harder it is for us to imagine ever moving back to D.C., ever trying to make that D.C. lifestyle work for us again. And that's really the bottom line for us.
Last thing, Chris, and then I'll let you go. You write in the epilogue, you come clean. You're a data guy through and through, right? I mean, you've got a little chart on the back page of this book talking about, you know, decrease in blood pressure, 30 points. Humans created, 1. And, you know, all these data points you came up with through this book. But
absolutely,
you basically then say, you know what? Data sometimes doesn't tell the whole story. And your subjective experiences in this book kind of prove the lie, right?
You know, that's one of the things I've been thinking a lot about since we got out here. It's really driven home to me that there's just a lot about life and governance and economics that we can't and we probably shouldn't be trying to capture just with numbers, that we probably shouldn't trying to be just boiling down to a cell on a spreadsheet. And for a normal person, this is probably an obvious insight. But for me as a data guy, and I suspect for a lot of other reporters who have been trained to look for the hard numbers that you can anchor your ideas to, it's a real helpful corrective, I think.
Chris Ingram is a data reporter at the Washington Post, living and working out of Red Lake County, Minnesota. His new book is called If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now. Chris, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can see that chart I mentioned, Chris Ingram and family's first year in Red Lake County, by the numbers, and a link to that ranking of all the counties. It's at marketplace.org, of course. You got your technology startups, and then you got the story Stephen Beard's about to tell us from 100 feet beneath the streets of Clapham, London, England, where this evening's dinner salad is being grown. Here's Stephen.
Not the most picturesque farm entrance. To get in here, you have to squeeze into a small ancient elevator along with a couple of farmhands and then rattle down 100 feet underground.
Can't afford to be claustrophobic in this job.
No, that would be a bit of a nightmare.
At the bottom of the shaft, the scene does look slightly nightmarish. Two parallel tunnels, a third of a mile long, bathed in an eerie pink light. The 20 or so staff dressed in white lab coats, surgical boots, hairnets and face masks.
We're a pest-free site, so there's nothing down here that we want getting into the site. And this is just an extra layer of protection.
It's almost a surgical environment or operating theatre.
Yeah, exactly.
Farmhand come technician Bethany Thurston says the tunnels were built as a World War II air raid shelter. Once lined with bunk beds for 8,000 people, they're now lined with vertically stacked trays, growing a wide variety of vegetables and herbs.
We've got broccoli, salad rocket, coriander, fennel. We've got the pea shoots, the sunflower shoots, two types of radish.
There's no soil on this farm. The crops are all grown on the trays, exposed to pink LED lighting in place of sunshine, and bathed in water containing all the essential nutrients.
So here we're on the irrigation level, so we're directly beneath the growing space in the farm.
That's grower Greg Crawford.
And we store the tanks here, and pumps pump the water up into the farm. It irrigates the crop. And the water comes back through down here again, where it's cleaned and we constantly recycle it.
The underground farmers who are selling their produce to all the main supermarket chains and some local restaurants have two enormous advantages over their traditional counterparts. No pests, so they don't need to spray, and they never have to worry about the weather.
You're not in any way dependent on the vagaries of climate change.
Exactly, yeah. It's very predictable, very controlled, so there's no frost down here, there's no heat waves down here, it's all standardised.
A trolley laden with red cabbage, watercress and fennel trundles by. The co-founder of Growing Underground, Steve Dring, looks on with missionary enthusiasm. His aim, he says, is simple.
It's about using the technology that's out there to sustainably intensify the yields. We need to look at different ways of growing food.
And his way of growing it, he says, is both sustainable and very intensive.
If we grow peas in a field, you'd get three crops a year. You grow them under glass, old glass 20 a year, modern glass 30 a year. Here we get 62 crops a year because we're precisely giving them exactly what they want all year round.
Soil erosion, population growth and climate change, Dring says, all mean that traditional farming won't on its own be able to feed the planet.
We have to produce more food. The current business as usual model of agriculture isn't fit for purpose.
But are the conditions of underground farming fit for the workers, like Greg Crawford? A giant fan blows fresh air into the tunnels, but this is hardly like having the wind in your hair.
Wouldn't you prefer to be a real farmer, Greg, up there haymaking in the sun?
Well, we're at the cutting edge here, so it is definitely, it's very interesting. We're pushing the boundaries here, and that is exciting. But I do miss the sunshine a little bit.
Growing Underground is not making a profit yet, but expects to do so by the middle of next year. Then it could, financially at least, put conventional farming in the shade. In London, 100 feet underground, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, which I'll begin by noting that shares of Alphabet, Google's parent company, closed basically flat today. And that's even with the news that attorneys general from 48 states are investigating Google on antitrust grounds. So that's the news. The reality is that these kinds of investigations can take like a decade or more, gang. See also Microsoft and AT&T. Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. Dow Industrials up 38 points today, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ down 15 points, nearly two-tenths of 1%. S&P 500 basically flat, plus about a quarter of a point. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.